Thank you for attending the course entitled Preparing Your IRA Beneficiaries for the Future. Before we get started, I was looking at some data, and there's over $37 trillion in retirement plans today. That's a pretty big number. And another data that shocked me is the fact that there's over 13, almost $14 trillion of the $37 trillion in IRAs, whereas around $11 trillion are contained in what we call defined contribution plans. In other words, a lot of assets have accumulated in these particular retirement plans. And what do we do to prepare for the future? As a matter of fact, what are your goals with that with those dollars that you have accumulated in your retirement plan? I'm a father, and I'm in a season of my life that I'm thinking about legacy. How do I ensure that the rightful heirs of what I've worked hard for get it? And that's the focus of today's webinar. More than just anything that concerns building wealth, how do we transfer wealth to our loved ones moving forward? But before we get started, I have to do these indemnification language or spiel out there so that people know that the Entrust Group does not provide investment advice or endorse any products. All the information materials are purely for educational purposes only, and parties are encouraged to consult with their attorneys, accountants, and financial advisors before entering into any type of investment or any decision for the matter concerning their retirement plans, their hard-earned retirement plans. The agenda for today, again, is talking about first about the fundamentals of self-directed IRAs. Why is that important? Because a lot of people that are attending this course have a self-directed retirement plan. And for some, I don't know if you've noticed, but the growth on self-directed accounts because of the investments that you have chosen are growing more exponentially than other types of investments that are regularly available or readily available for the public. With those hard-earned dollars that you have in a retirement plan, again, what's the next step? What's the legacy plan in the event that you're no longer around? There's still going to be balances in IRAs. So therefore, we need to take a look at what steps do you need to take to constantly or annually review the documentation that you have in your retirement plans to ensure that the rightful heirs get the hard-earned assets that you have in these retirement plans so that they can enjoy those in the future, whether it be your spouse, your children, even a family member like a brother or a sister. Or maybe even transferring those assets to a charitable institution for estate planning purposes. But this is just going to touch on some of the basics that you need to know, or as a starting point to make sure that your documentation is all set to go, so that it, at any time, we don't know when that is, that if you do pass away, that you have set forth or put forth an effort to lay out the plan on who gets the assets that you worked really hard for. So we're going to go through IRA beneficiary basics, and as well as what do you need to communicate to your beneficiaries? In other words, I don't know about you, but how many beneficiaries do you think out there do not even know that they're named as a beneficiary under an individual's account? We joke about it in the industry that, you know, once the IRA holder passes away, and they didn't put forth enough information on these documents, who are we going to call? Most cases, we cannot call anybody because the IRA holder had passed away already. So in other words, what type of communication or conversations do we suggest you have with your beneficiaries so that they know what to do or what steps to take upon the IRA holder's death? We'll also take a look at some common legacy planning mistakes or common errors that not only IRA holders, decide on, but also some common errors that beneficiaries may take because of lack of information. And that's why this particular webinar, we felt it was essential to inform our IRA holders, as well as other people that are attending this course that are interested in our educational programs, on what they need to know to make sure that they don't make those particular mistakes. And last but not least, we'll take a look at some beneficiary items to take a look at. In other words, a checklist that beneficiaries can use to make sure that they have enough information to inherit those assets, as well as steps to take to make sure that they communicate with the custodian in a timely fashion to avoid unintended consequences such as penalties. And last but not least, we'll open up the phones for any questions you may have in regards to the material presented. So as I go through the material, and I'm shooting for around 50 minutes to an hour for the material, and then we'll open up the phone lines for any questions you may have. I don't guarantee that we're going to be able to answer all the questions, similar to the last course that I taught. There were so many questions, but we will allot some time to for a Q&A portion of this webinar. And if you still have questions that that you wanted to ask, but due to time, we may not be able to answer those questions, send those questions to us anyway, and we can I will respond to those questions at a later time. All right. Let's take a look at enough of me. My name is John Paul Ruiz. I'm the Director of Professional Development here at the Entrust Group. And not only do we educate our staff to service our clients, but we also educate the industry. What does that mean? I've founded and wrote a course called the IRA Academy, which individuals in the industry take to prepare themselves for what we call the Certified IRA Services Professional Designation through the American Banking Association. So welcome. Hello, my name is John Paul Ruiz, and I'll be your instructor for today's webinar. Let's see here. All right. About the Entrust Group, we've been around for 40 years, servicing the self-directed world. We have $4 billion of assets under administration. But the thing that delineates us from the rest is that we have a robust education program. We feel that education can drive assisting users like yourself, or in other words, taxpayers like yourself, to find out more about what's available in the retirement space, as well as what steps you may want to know about, so that as you have conversations with your attorneys, your CPAs, that you have the vocabulary to be able to formulate questions with your professionals that you work with. Now, the IRA administrator, we do not offer any investments at all. What we do is we offer a platform that allows for you, the taxpayer, to choose your own investment with the assistance of an advisor, to vet out an investment, an attorney to take out the legal terms, as well as a tax consultant to take a look at what tax ramifications may be associated with investments that you may have chosen. The Entrust Group, again, is just the repository, or in other words, we are the ones that allow for you to maintain these particular investments on a tax-deferred status. In other words, the earnings on these accounts will not get taxed until you take a distribution. You need a custodian and a record keeper, and that's what the Entrust Group plays. Along with that, we take it a little bit of a step further. We give general pieces of information that allows for you, the taxpayer, to make informed decisions. Our staff is knowledgeable. We have a varying degree of experience with our staff. We do have some offices nationwide, brick and mortar offices, where there's an actual physical person that can actually service your accounts. We also hold in-person events and virtual events, just like this one. Again, we do have a national continuing education program, not only for the CISP designation. Our courses are also approved for continuing education credits for CPAs, certified financial planners, enrolled agents with the IRS, as well as other designations such as the Certified Trust Financial Advisor and other designations as well. We hold what we call the IRA Academy twice a year. Now, what is a self-directed IRA? It's a retirement account, again, in which the investor is in charge of making all the investment decisions, as well as, let me take that a step further, you're even in charge to figure out what you want to put under your IRAs. In other words, we will give you the container, the documents. We will provide the record keeping. But it's up to the taxpayer to locate your investment. Let me give an example. Somebody's driving down the road and said, you know what, I'm not quite fond of stocks, bonds, and mutual funds any longer. Can I take a portion of that and transfer it to my Entrust IRA so that I can instruct Entrust to purchase, let's say, an apartment complex? That is possible with the Entrust group, whereas in some other organizations, that's not what they specialize in. We specialize in custodying assets that are typically not handled in your regular financial institutions. Now, when I say custody, the Entrust group actually has a trust company charter in the state of Tennessee. So not only are we a record keeper, we also have a credible institution, a financial institution that is audited and scrutinized on a yearly basis by the state of Tennessee, because that's where our trust charter resides. With a self-directed account, it gives an opportunity for a greater asset diversification. In other words, if somebody wants gold IRA beyond stocks, bonds, and mutual funds, you can hold those under a retirement plan as long as they're approved or acceptable investments according to the Internal Revenue Service. All securities and investments are also held in a retirement account administered by, again, a regulated custodian or trustee, and that's the Entrust group, given that we do have a trust charter in the state of Tennessee. Now let's get into the material, all right? Beneficiary basics. The IRAs that individuals establish, I don't know if you know this, but a lot of people don't know that an IRA is a valid trust under state law. In other words, when you sign that document called an IRA, or in other words, when you sign an application called an IRA, and it says that I have received what we call the IRS Form 5305. The IRS Form 5305 is the model language that the IRS provides that establishes what we call an IRA. It's not the account in a record-keeping system, or it's not the asset that you hold under your IRA. The IRA is actually a document. Given the fact that an IRA is a valid trust under state law, just like other accounts, you can, you as the IRA holder, can actually name individuals that would inherit your IRA in the event of your death. And that's what we're talking about today. Those people that could inherit your assets that you name are what we call beneficiaries. In other words, a beneficiary, from a beneficiary perspective, legacy planning is the process of defining how your wealth will be transferred to somebody else, or maybe even the next generation after you pass away. Now, I don't know about you. I don't plan on passing away anytime soon, but it'd be nice to prepare for it. If you're married, who would you name? Is it better to name a spouse, or is it if you're not married or you may not have a spouse any longer, who can you name? Children, or maybe even a sibling, parents, or maybe even a charitable institution. But nonetheless, you have control on who gets your assets upon your death, as long as you understand that that beneficiary designation form is completed properly as well as accurately. In other words, not only do you put a name in there, you might also want to put the relationships between you and the beneficiary, because certain beneficiaries, such as the spouse, has additional options that they could avail of upon the death of the original IRA holder that they could benefit further during their lifetime as well. And I'll explain that a step further as we go through this particular course. The pieces of the puzzle, again, are as follows. It's you, the IRA holder. Who do you want to name as a beneficiary? If an IRA holder does not name a beneficiary under an IRA and elects to name a beneficiary, well, most IRA documents, if not all of them that I've seen out there in the industry, does name one on your behalf. And the typical beneficiary that the documents default to is what we call the estate of an individual. Background on estate. If you leave it to the estate, either by election or by default, that asset may go through a process of what we call probate. Probate makes your assets become public record. In other words, the public can see that you have assets that you have left upon your death to an estate, and it's going to be divvied up based on what the probate court deems appropriate based on a certain document. That document is what we call a will. Think to yourself, self, how many people do you think out there do not have a will? If you don't have a will, that means that you may have died without a testament. In other words, you die intestate. And guess what? The state will be more than happy to write your who gets your assets upon your death, since you didn't have a will. So what's the message of the story here? If an individual names a beneficiary under an IRA, it will not go through the process called probate. In other words, the assets are deemed to be what we call non-probatable assets. As a matter of fact, creditors will not be able to see the assets that you have in your IRA, because by operation of law, the custodian or the trustee of your IRA is the one that will determine who gets the assets based on a document that you've completed called a beneficiary designation form. However, if that beneficiary designation form is not completed properly and accurately, well, then the custodian and trustee may have issues in regards to, number one, locating the beneficiary, and number two, communicating to the beneficiary that they have assets that have been left on their behalf under this particular custodian. So we have the IRA holder, we have the beneficiaries, they have the inherited IRA, and last but not least, the custodian involved in this particular process. Let's take a poll. How prepared are you, are your beneficiaries? Number one, I have educated my beneficiaries on inherited IRAs. I've informed my beneficiaries that they were named under my IRA. Or not at all. My beneficiaries don't know they're named. And neither, I have not named beneficiaries. Based on information that I've given you already, answer it as honestly as you can, and we'll take a look at where people are at. We're all going to stay anonymous in this particular process.
Actually, JP, if we could, with this one, the poll is not loaded per usual, so if we could have everybody, if you want to answer this, please answer within the questions box with just very, somewhat, not, or neither. And as JP said, if you would like to remain anonymous and don't feel like you want to participate, please don't feel pressured to. But we'll give it about a minute here and see how many we get. Okay, JP, it seems like we've kind of trickled down to how many we're going to get. And again, if you are still thinking about this, feel free to provide your answer as JP continues on with the presentation. And if you need me to refresh the question, just send that in the questions box and I will let you know. Thank you very much, JP.
You're very welcome. It seemed to have struck a chord in regards to the poll questions. A lot of people have answered somewhat, not very. You may want to check with your tax and legal advisor and start those conversations with them. That regardless of how old you are, it is good to be prepared for that fortuitous event, unfortunate event, that some people may pass away sooner than others. It is good to be prepared on who gets the assets of your that you work so hard for. Who would you like to get those assets? And that's why we take these polls, to make sure that people's minds are churning or thinking in regards to preparing for the future of their IRAs. Why would you want to name a beneficiary? Naming beneficiary aligns your investing legacy and your financial plans to what your goals are. What does that mean? What do you want to accomplish? Are you saving this money in your IRA for yourself when you retire? Or are you thinking about accumulating wealth in your IRA so that you can pass it on to the next generation? In other words, it creates a structure of handling the inheritance of your assets from yourself to your rightful heirs, whether it be your spouse, whether it be your children. Things to think about are, you know, how's your health? I'm not saying, again, that people are going to die anytime soon, but be prepared for it. How's your health? Are you planning on living a long period of time? Who do you want your assets to go to? For estate planning purposes, in some cases, it may be better to name your children instead of your spouse as a beneficiary. Those are the conversations you may want to have with your competent tax or legal advisor or even estate planner. It better prepares them to help you realize your goals if they are informed that they are named beneficiaries under an individual's IRA. In other words, some beneficiaries, if they don't know that they are named beneficiaries under a person's IRA, at that fortuitous event, how would they know what the next steps are? Not naming beneficiaries has some repercussions again. If by not naming a beneficiary, depending upon the IRA document that you use, the typical default again is the individual's estate. Now, some IRA documents out there that I've seen as well, and I have helped construct for other people or other financial institutions, is reads as follows: that if a person is married and they didn't name a beneficiary, then the spouse is ultimately the beneficiary. I hope I said that correctly. If a person is married and they didn't name a beneficiary, well, guess what? Upon the death of the IRA holder, it would automatically go to the spouse. That sounds great. If they're not married, then it'll go to the children. And if there are no children, then it'll go to the estate. There's been some situations that I've seen out there where the individual was married. And of course, the spouse passed away. The spouse beneficiary passed away. And of course, based on the way the document is written, if an IRA holder's beneficiary predeceases the IRA holder, they're going to be viewed as if they weren't there. In other words, they would be viewed as if there was no beneficiary. The individual gets married, remarried. And of course, the way the document was written is that if the IRA holder passes away and there's no named beneficiary, the spouse becomes the beneficiary. And in this case, it's the new spouse. And of course, the children are now out of the picture because the new spouse gets everything. So it's really a matter of understanding what's in your document. I'm just giving you the general things that I've seen out there at the Entrust Group. Our document defaults to the estate if you don't name a beneficiary. Know who gets what upon your death. And also make sure that the custodian has enough information on who the beneficiary is, the relationship of the beneficiary and yourself, as well as the way to contact that beneficiary upon your death. The assets, again, may be subject to the will depending upon the size of the assets of an individual. Certain thresholds of assets under an individual's estate may require a probate estate to be opened up or not. If it's too small, then the counties will just ask for what we call an affidavit of a small estate, which means some of the assets may already have beneficiaries named under those accounts, such as IRAs, so therefore those are non-probatable assets, so therefore an estate may not even be open. But, however, let's say you had a $500,000 apartment complex, and you pass away. And of course, the beneficiary, if there's not one named under the entrust document, it would default to the estate. But then, of course, those assets will be distributed to your estate, to that individual's estate that did not name a beneficiary. Not only it became available as public record, it'll also be subject to a procedure called probate. Now, probate is not cheap. Counties do not do this for free. They will get all the assets appraised to determine the value of the individual's estate. They will try to locate a will if there is one, or any codicils to that will. In other words, addendums to that will to determine who the rightful heirs are. Generally, the court will require that a publication be issued out in a newspaper or some sort of publication that says an individual has passed away. If there are any more current wills or codicils to this will, you better come to the probate court so we can determine who the rightful heirs are. Let's say all that is done. Guess who the initial creditor would be for that individual's estate? Well, the main one would be the court. What if there's no cash? in that particular individual's estate. How can the creditors get paid? Well, I don't know if you've heard of what we call an estate sale. Half of the time, most of the time, estate sales are auctioning out individuals' assets, not only to transfer the assets to the beneficiaries, but before that, creditors need to get paid. So how do you avoid all that? Just name a beneficiary under your IRA. And as a matter of fact, have a develop a communication strategy with your beneficiary so that they would know what to do upon your death. Anyway, enough said about the urgency of naming a beneficiary as well as educating your beneficiaries. Evaluating your beneficiary tree. To prepare your beneficiaries, you must understand the flow of the funds for each contingency. In other words, in most documents, you can name a certain set of beneficiary or beneficiaries, or maybe the beneficiary in an entity called primary beneficiaries. The initial line of individuals or entities that could be naming your IRAs are what we call your primary beneficiaries. Now, keep in mind, if you've named primary beneficiaries before, there may have also been some life changes that may have occurred that would be suggested to update your beneficiary designation forms. Some attorneys or some CPAs recommend that for every 3 years, review your beneficiary designation forms from all your accounts to make sure that it still reflects the wishes that you have upon your death. These primary beneficiaries are typically, again, the first line of person or persons that will receive your assets upon your death. Most documents out there called beneficiary designation forms are written on what we call a per capita basis. It's a legal term that sets off the head. That means if any primary beneficiary predeceases you, in other words, they die before you, they lose out on the entitlement of the proportionate share that you would have left for them. And the remaining primary beneficiaries will receive their proportionate share. Let's say you have three children. Let's say you have Joe, Jim, and Sarah, right? Just a quick beneficiary designation form class. You could allot a certain percentage for the three beneficiaries that you may have. You could also favor one of them over the others. But by allotting percentages, then the custodian would know how much each beneficiary would get. In some cases, you could even put an attachment to that beneficiary designation form and allocate a certain investment that somebody is going to receive upon your death. In other words, in a self-directed world, somebody may have 10 houses. It's kind of hard to cut a house three ways. So therefore, IRA holders may say, well, this house, this property is allotted for this individual. This property is allotted for this individual. That gives much clarity for the custodian to execute what you have left as a document to execute again upon your death. Some IRA holders may also establish multiple IRAs, so that in each one of those IRAs, they could name a separate beneficiary. All those are strategies that need to be discussed with your tax or legal advisor. Now, what if no primary beneficiary survives the IRA holder? In other words, they all die before you do. Wouldn't it be nice to have a succession plan or a contingent plan? Another set of beneficiaries that could be named are what we call contingent beneficiaries. Those are what we call your contingent plan. What happens if all the primary beneficiaries are predeceases you? Wouldn't it be nice that the document already has that set up? What that means again is take a look at your beneficiary designation forms. It may need to be updated, especially if you have had an IRA to interest group for a long period of time. People may have gotten married. Or maybe you may have gotten a life event called a divorce. Those particular types of issues can cause the wrong person or the wrong entity to receive your assets upon your death. Again, evaluate your beneficiary tree as well as determine whether or not it needs to be updated. What benefactors and beneficiaries must know? Let's take a look at this particular chart right here. Education is the best preparation. Demystify the complexities of what we call an inherited IRA. I don't know if you know this, that when an IRA holder passes away, by law, those assets pass on to the beneficiaries, and the custodian has to report those, whatever the percentage is or an investment, under the right name and social security number for future purposes, for not only for reporting, but also for taxation. There are also options available to the beneficiary to postpone taxation. In other words, how quickly must they deplete the account upon the death of the IRA holder? Imagine if you have, again, a $500,000 apartment complex under an IRA. Think about it. For those of you who are, you know, familiar with how taxation works, there's a lot of taxes involved in $500,000. What if I told you that the beneficiaries actually have options to only incrementally deplete the IRA? In other words, take a small required minimum distribution. Instead of taking out the $500,000 based on the options available under the Treasury regulations, how would it be if the beneficiary only had to take an incremental amount out on a yearly basis? Therefore, they could prolong the tax deferment of that $500,000 apartment complex under your IRA, but it's held under what we call an inherited account. The reason why this is important to understand is if that $500,000 apartment complex was distributed by the beneficiary because of lack of knowledge, it just caused them an unintended tax consequence. We'll take a look at some of those options later on in this course. Also, preparing your beneficiary provides a structure for managing an IRA. In other words, if they know what they got, they'll be able to know how to direct a custodian on how to handle that particular IRA, as well as it gives the beneficiaries a head start in understanding what they'll be inheriting in the future as long as they remain as a beneficiary under your particular IRA. Now, what does the custodian need in that beneficiary designation form? Contact information for that beneficiary, a date of birth, a social security number, a tax identification number if it's the estate or even a trust, and last but not least, a relationship. Assets in an IRA that have what we call a required minimum distribution, and that's what the IRS will require for beneficiaries to conduct or distribute every year. If those assets come back, or no, it becomes stagnant for a certain period of time, and generally it's 3 years, a lot of those assets may have to be turned over to the state. To avoid that, you may want to talk to your custodian to make sure that your beneficiary designation forms contain enough information so that the custodian or the trustee of your IRA will have enough information upon receipt of a death certificate to contact those beneficiaries to educate or to brief them on what their options are and understand, and hopefully if you have communicated that with them, that they do understand what their options are, what the next steps are, because there are certain deadlines to make those particular elections. And that's typically December 31st of the year following the year of death. It's not a long time, but it's also not a short time. Not knowing what to do or not knowing what options are available to them, again, could cause some unintended tax consequence. Let me give you an example. If an individual has a retirement plan that requires the whole account to be distributed, and if it's not distributed in a timely fashion, the penalty for it is what we call the excess accumulation penalty of 50%. Imagine Uncle Sam taking 50% of the assets because the beneficiary, number one, didn't know that their name is the beneficiary, and number two, they didn't know that they had to take a distribution as of a certain time frame. And that's why we're conducting this particular seminar, is not only educate you, but hopefully a conversation between you and your beneficiaries are happening to make sure that they don't suffer those unintended tax consequences if they inherit or when they inherit your IRAs. The typical options of a beneficiary will be determined based on how old you are when you die. When a person reaches the magical age of age 72 for a traditional IRA, an individual must start taking what we call required minimum distributions. However, if you died before turning age 72, in other words, turning of age to that you started to take required minimum distributions, there are typically two options. The first option a beneficiary could elect by December 31st of the year following the year of death is what we call the five-year rule. Not a lot of beneficiaries choose this option. And what that means is that if they elect to choose the five-year rule option, well, they don't have to do anything until the year that contains the fifth anniversary of an IRA holder's death. So in other words, if someone dies this year, they have until the fifth year to deplete the account that they've inherited. In other words, if they wait until that fifth year, everything has to be distributed. But if they don't distribute it, the penalty is 50%. Again, that $500,000 apartment complex that I'm using as an example. You know, again, 50% of $500,000 is a lot of money. And it's going to be paid to the IRS because, again, the beneficiary may not have known that they're distributed. The other option beneficiaries have is what we call the life expectancy option. The distribution is determined on an incremental basis from year to year, beginning December 31st of the year following the IRA holder's year of death, by taking a small amount by using the life expectancy of the beneficiary to determine the small amount that we distributed every year. In other words, the custodians will typically take the prior year end balance and the life expectancy of the beneficiary. As an example, if a beneficiary is, let's say, 30 years old, generally the life expectancy of a 30-year-old, according to the IRS tables, is 51. Imagine the beneficiary being able to stretch out the tax deferment of those assets under the inherited IRA for 51 years. That's a powerful, powerful tool. Now, again, the five-year rule and life expectancy option are the general rules available for a beneficiary if the IRA holder died before they started taking RMDs. Now, what if an IRA holder had already started taking RMDs? Well, it boils down to having two options, now limited to one. Therefore, every year, the beneficiary will have to take out a life expectancy distribution under the deceased IRA holder's IRA. Now, why would somebody want to keep those assets under a deceased IRA holder's IRA? Number one, to avoid taxation. Because unless you distribute it, it's not going to get taxed. So in some cases, beneficiaries may only want to distribute what's required by law. Another thing about an inherited account is that those distributions, regardless of how old the beneficiary is, will be exempt from the 10% early distribution penalty. Why is that? Because the moment a person passes away, distributions to beneficiaries are exempt from the 10% early distribution penalty. So if your goal is to leave your hard-earned retirement plan assets to your beneficiaries, you might want to educate them on these two particular options. Again, before the required beginning date, we have the five-year rule option, which a lot of beneficiaries do not avail of. And we also have what we call the life expectancy option. A spouse may even want to keep the account under their deceased spouse's IRA. Again, because the distributions of those from those accounts are exempt from the early distribution penalty. Once they move those assets to their own IRA, in other words, if they decide to take a distribution and roll it to their own IRA or a transfer to the IRA, which, by the way, the spouse is the only one that has that option. Other people do not. And let's say the spouse is only 55 years old. Well, the 55-year-old is under the age of 59 and a half. Now that they move the assets to their own IRA, they'll be subject to a 10% early distribution penalty. So in some cases, the strategy is the spouse keeps the assets under the deceased individual's IRA or moves a portion of it to their own and retains a portion of it under the deceased spouse's IRA to avoid that early distribution penalty by taking those distributions under that inherited account. Now, there's also new rules that came about based on what we call the SECURE Act. For individuals that died prior to tax year 2020, they had what we call the five-year option and life expectancy payments. However, with the passage of the SECURE Act, there were some changes that Congress did for those two options. And here they are as follows. But before we give you the options, let's take a look at how those particular changes affected certain types of beneficiaries. Certain beneficiaries called eligible designated beneficiaries were not affected by the SECURE Act. In other words, they still maintained that life expectancy distribution, which could potentially stretch out the tax deferment of those assets under an individual's IRA. The ones that were affected are what we call termed as designated beneficiaries. To be specific, non-spouse beneficiaries that are more than 10 years younger. A good example of that would be children. Children that are greater than 10 years younger from the IRA holder. They no longer have the life expectancy option. Non-spouse beneficiaries that are greater than 10 years younger, if a person dies after tax year 2019, will only be subject to what we call the 10-year rule option. The 10-year rule option is similar to your 5-year rule option, but you're given 10 years to deplete the account, but can no longer extend the life of that inherited account for the life expectancy of the beneficiary. In other words, let's say an IRA holder died in tax year 2021. Of course, in this particular example, we have a son who is 30 years younger than the parent. That son will have 10 years to deplete that account, but cannot use their life expectancy to deplete that account any longer. However, if it was a spouse, the spouse still has the option to deplete that incrementally using their life expectancy. Or if you, let's say you name a brother or a sister that's only 5 years younger, they still have the life expectancy option. Or minors, in other words, individuals who have not reached age of majority, and the typical legal age is 18. They can continue taking life expectancy distributions, but once they turn legal age, then now they'd be subject to the 10-year rule option. And last but not least, what if your beneficiary is an individual who's considered differently abled or chronically ill? There's a special provision for those particular beneficiaries to maintain what we call the life expectancy option. And last but not least, we have what we call non-individuals, or in other words, non-designated beneficiaries, charities, and estates. Well, guess what? There's no effect to them. They still have the 5-year rule option before the individual starts taking RMDs. And they also have the option of using the IRA holder's age to take incremental distributions moving forward. Now, again, here are the options available to beneficiaries upon the death of the IRA holder if they died after 2019. Eligible designated beneficiaries can use their life expectancy to incrementally deplete that account prospectively. Designated beneficiaries, in other words, non-spouse beneficiaries that are greater than 10 years younger, only have the 10-year rule option. In other words, they must deplete that account on the 10th year. If not, they'll be subject to what we call the 50% excess accumulation penalty. Non-designated beneficiaries, or in other words, estates, or charitable institutions as an example, have the 5-year rule option if the IRA holder died prior to taking required minimum distributions, or the life expectancy option if the IRA holder died after reaching the age of 72 and had started taking required minimum distributions. Again, whose life expectancy will they use? They'll use the deceased IRA holder's age to determine life expectancy. Again, I don't expect for you to be an expert at what these options are, but at least in the back of your mind, know that there are options and there are conversations that have to take place depending upon where you're at in your journey of having an IRA to make sure that your beneficiaries know what to do and when to do certain things that could affect the amounts that they're inheriting from your IRA. Again, for a spouse, there is that special rule that the spouse can move the assets from their deceased spouse's IRA to their own. But there are some advantages of not moving it right away in certain situations. But just know that the spouse can move it to their own IRA at any given time. When there are multiple beneficiaries, however, what happens? If there are multiple beneficiaries, we typically use the oldest beneficiary for life expectancy purposes. However, there's a special rule, according to the IRS, that if inherited accounts are established by December 31st, in other words, one of the first steps that beneficiaries must take once an IRA holder passes away is to notify the custodian. notify the custodian that the IRA holder has passed away. Because if the inherited accounts are established in a timely fashion, individuals who could possibly benefit by making the amount, the incremental distribution smaller, would require that those inherited accounts be established by a certain deadline. And that deadline is December 31st of the year following the year of death. Individuals who also name pieces of paper called trusts could also have what we call a life expectancy option. Let's say an individual names a trust as a beneficiary on behalf of their spouse. The IRS fully knows fully well for a long period of time, since 1987, that if a trust is named as a beneficiary of pieces of paper, it's really intended for an individual in most cases. In other words, if the trust is what we call a qualified trust, in other words, it has to be valid under state law, has identifiable beneficiaries. In my example, it may be the spouse. And the provisions of the trust has to be irrevocable upon death. In other words, nobody can make changes to it. The custodian can actually look at the oldest beneficiary of that trust to determine the life expectancy and further, in other words, come up with a life expectancy distribution, which would reduce the amount of taxation on an incremental basis during the life of that beneficiary. I know I'm talking a lot of fancy-smancy terms here, but jot your questions down, and we're going to open up the phone lines later on for any questions you may have in regards to the materials being presented. Proper titling of the account is required, so therefore the beneficiaries must also be notified that by providing the death certificate, it allows for the custodian to properly retitle the account that automatically makes distributions from that account be penalty free. As a matter of fact, here are the examples that the IRS provides for us on how that account would be titled, so that distributions from that account would also be identified accordingly. John Doe, let's say, is the IRA holder, deceased, for benefit of Jane Doe. So for those accounts, the IRS would know that that's an inherited account. Jane Doe, beneficiary of John Doe. So once they've inherited that account, their account under the custodian, of course, if there's multiple beneficiaries, they'll have their own individual separate account, would be titled as follows. Teach them the rules. Teach them the investment restrictions, because they're the ones that are going to be carrying out your account that you establish in their behalf. If you have multiple houses, notes, gold, whatever it may be, try to educate them on what they can do with those assets and continue on your legacy under your IRA after you pass away. Life insurance contracts are not allowed. Collectibles are also not allowed under an IRA. And last but not least, S corporations. However, the world of investment opportunities out there await and are available to them upon your death, just like you did while you were alive. Prohibited transactions are also something that beneficiaries may want to know about. One good way to educate your beneficiaries as we speak is sign them up for the interest mailing letters. In other words, even though they don't have an account at the interest group, they are able to attend our courses, so that they can educate themselves on what to do upon inheriting an account that you may have left them. Again, teach them about prohibited transaction rules. In other words, improper use of an IRA will cause that IRA to be fully taxable in the year that that IRA becomes deemed engaging in a prohibited transaction. So in other words, like, you can't live in the property that's held under your inherited account. You cannot pay yourself from that inherited account. You can take a distribution, you can't pay yourself from an investment under that IRA, or you cannot extend credit. Those are what we're talking about prohibited transactions. Understand the rules, but also teach your inheritors what the rules are, so that they can continue on with your, again, legacy of having a self-directed IRA. Disqualified persons include you, your spouse, your lineal descendants, including the beneficiaries, by the way, your trustee, your custodian, or anybody providing services to your IRA, as well as any in any corporation that you actually own yourself. So in other words, these are the general rules called prohibited transaction. Teach your beneficiaries what those are. Remember, now that they've inherited the account, there are still some fees that need to be paid. Make them aware that if they want to maintain that inherited account and avoid some unintended tax consequences, that they will be the one in charge of making those fee payments. Most custodians out there, if not all of them, would resign as a custodian if fees are not getting paid. So therefore, again, what if there was a $500,000 apartment complex held under an individual's IRA and they didn't pay the fees? Well, that $500,000 apartment complex will, of course, be distributed to them. How to avoid that? Just continue maintaining the account at the custodian. Avoid legacy planning mistakes. We're almost done with the presentation, and I'd love to answer your questions. Jot your questions down. One common mistake inheritors have is that, number one, they take a total distribution of what they've inherited from the IRA holder, not knowing that those assets are going to be taxable in the year of distribution. By educating them on what their options are, it will help them to make some sound decisions on what to do with that particular account. Help them to understand what their options are to postpone taxation so that they do not take a total distribution, because those assets cannot be put back in once it comes out, unless, of course, it's the spouse. Communicate your beneficiaries to your beneficiaries that they are named as a beneficiary under that under your IRA, so that they know when you pass away that there's something coming to them under a custodian. Wouldn't it be a shame if the custodian could not find the beneficiary that later on those assets that you worked so hard for gets turned over to the state? In other words, that's what we call escheatment. Those assets could eventually be escheated to the state. And in some cases, the state would say, if it's a piece of real estate as an example, we won't escheat those because there's already a procedure that happens in a county if, for example, property taxes aren't paid. If property taxes aren't paid, those become a tax lien, and an individual could lose those assets through what we call a tax lien option. Therefore, the ownership of the assets that you worked hard for under an IRA would revert to ownership of somebody else because the beneficiary did not know that they were named as a beneficiary. Again, we can't reiterate enough, give proper instructions to beneficiaries to avoid unintended taxation and penalties. Required minimum distributions are still mandatory for beneficiaries. If they fail to take out a minimum amount, there's a 50% penalty on those minimum amounts as well, the small incremental distributions. Now, 50% is a lot of money, but knowing what to do and when to do it will avoid that penalty. Here's a checklist that you could go by in regards to reviewing your beneficiary designation forms on a yearly basis. Name the beneficiaries that you want in your IRAs and other accounts. Submit your beneficiary designation forms as well as update it with what you feel comfortable. Is it yearly, or is it every 2 years or 3 years, or only when there's a life change? Because whatever is on record will not automatically change. You would have to affirmatively change those beneficiary designation forms. And of course, not only sign the form, but date it. Because when it comes to determining which is the most current beneficiary designation form, a common mistake that I see out there is there are forms that are signed, but not dated. So the court or the custodian cannot determine which one is the most current one. Prepare your beneficiaries, educate them, sign them up for a webinar like this so that they know what to do, or at least have it in the back of their mind to ask questions. Mentioned this already, update your beneficiary designation forms and stay updated on laws. And that's why we provide education or webinars so that you can have access to what we have access to make an informed decision. What's next? We have upcoming webinars that may be helpful not only for you, but for some of your beneficiaries to take. And also let us know if this webinar was helpful for you as you leave. It may be that your heads are spinning right now because there's a lot of information that I covered, but this is just the beginning of learning how to steward the assets that you've worked so hard for, not only to enjoy it while you're alive, but also to be able to hand that to the next generation. If you are interested in more information about self-directed IRAs, visit our website, and we also have what we call the Learning Center. The Learning Center has articles, recorded webinars that we may have done in the past, as well as podcasts or presentations that have been done by some industry experts in regards to some investments. And last but not least, follow us on social media for updates: Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter. Sign up for our newsletters so that we can continue to be in connection, so that whether or not we can answer the question for you or give you the vocabulary to be able to ask those questions to your tax or legal advisors, we are here to educate, not give advice or answer directly your specific question, but at least give you a starting point to get into the path of getting the information as well as making an informed decision. Well, let's open up the phone lines for any questions you may have in regards to the material presented.
Thank you, JP. All right, everybody.
Hey, Andrew, what
first question submitted?
Oh, okay, great. Go ahead.
Did you have a question, JP? Okay.
No, so you're going to read the questions for us. Great. Fantastic.
Yeah, sounds good. All right. Number one. So you covered this a bit, so let me know, JP, if you have any extra tidbits on this. But Linda was wondering, sure, as somebody who's new to inherited taxes and, you know, state or federal laws, how to avoid or what to avoid for their heirs. So how to educate them on what their heirs should be avoiding or what to avoid in this, you know, passing off inheritance phase. So we had a slide on that of how to avoid common mistakes. Is there any other best practices you have in mind or no?
I think the best thing is to communicate with your beneficiaries. Just know that some of the basics are whatever is taxable to the IRA holder is taxable to the beneficiaries. In other words, taxation is just passed on to the beneficiaries. There are also other accounts called Roth accounts that do not have taxation. Make sure that you pass on that information to the beneficiary. Or, in other words, even a strategy may need to be created right now with the assistance of your tax and legal advisors to say, you know, all these accounts that I have right now are taxable. How could I convert them into a non-taxable account for the future? And that is what we call a conversion. That may be appropriate for you. I can't answer that for you, but those are some of the strategies that individuals take. The reason for that is, depending upon the size of your estate, the estate may also be subject to additional taxation. As a matter of fact, there's a lot of stuff floating around out there that the current administration and Congress is basically trying to change or affect what we call the estate tax credit. In other words, lowering it back down to lower amounts that were previously associated with estate taxes. Talk to an estate tax planner whether or not a conversion may be good for you. Those are the types of things to explore with your tax advisors and legal advisors, and then instruct your beneficiaries accordingly. But generally, whatever affects the taxpayer will also affect the beneficiary. But the main thing that a beneficiary is exempt from, that IRA holders may not be exempt from, is what we call the early distribution penalty. So from that perspective, involve your advisors as well as communicate with your beneficiaries to make sure that they get the assets accordingly.
Thank you, JP. So you answered this, but just to reiterate, they asked, can heirs roll over assets directly into their IRAs? And you covered the answer would be no, correct?
The answer to that is non-spouse beneficiaries. In other words, if you have kids, sister, Those are non-spouses. But the spouse, however, can take a distribution and roll it over to their own IRA, but other inheritors cannot. So therefore, it is good to instruct non-spouse beneficiaries, such as your children, don't take a distribution. Don't take it all out, because the moment you take it all out, it's like the opposite of a roach motel. Once you get out, you can't get back in. Know what you can do within the confines of an inherited IRA to avoid getting taxed on the full amount. Try to avail of the incremental distributions that are available under the Treasury regulations to avoid full taxation immediately and actually to spread out taxation. So to answer the question, some can, some cannot. And that's spouse can, non-spouses cannot. I hope that answers and clarifies it a little bit better.
Thank you, JP.
Okay, Andrew.
Yep. Question for you, JP. Are you able to see the questions? The next one is quite lengthy, and I think it would be easier for you to understand if you read it and kind of digest what they're trying to say. If you can't see that, we might just move on to the next question while we figure that out, just because it is quite long.
Okay. Is this the one that says, I have passive AG investments?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I have passive AG investments in a traditional IRA and a Roth IRA. They are within an LLC in each. Currently, the beneficiaries are my son and my daughter, but my son is not married while my daughter is and has four teen and young adult children. If I die and name my son and my daughter 50-50 each, I don't want my son's half to go to his girlfriend if he dies. I want it to come back to my daughter's family or to charity. Total value is around, okay, I'm just going to leave it at the value because it's irrelevant at this point. Everybody doesn't need to know how much that is. Is there language that I can put into the LLC that would govern this? Could I make a new LLC, the beneficiary, and have that language in it to do this? Doesn't seem like a large enough amount to warrant a trust. And I don't know of a good trustee. I am the youngest of my generation, and I'm 72, recently widowed. Along with this, or part of my concern is that the kids actually long-term don't have the financial management skills. That's a very common issue as well. So I suggest that they keep the AG investments and just take the annual income under the investment ends or can be renewed by 20 or 30 years. Okay, that's a long question, but here's my answer. It will not be done through the LLC. All right, the LLC is just an investment under the IRA. The wishes of the IRA holder on who gets the assets is generally determined under the trust's language. So what could be done is set up, you know, two separate IRAs, and this is just a suggestion, I'm not to do. Set up two IRAs, one half of it, 50% named, or 100% of the 50% of the LLC be named under one IRA, and the 50% of the LLC also named a different beneficiary with special language on the account that the contingent beneficiary of the son would be the daughter or a charity. In other words, by chronological order, if you die and then you have, or if your son predeceases you, then it'll go to the contingent beneficiary. And if there's language in there also that if you die and the son inherits it, that what we call a successor beneficiary could already be named, that the son would name a charitable institution or the daughter as the beneficiary. That could be one thing. But generally, this thing could be handled via what we call a trust that is non-probatable, that is handled by, let's say, name the daughter as the trustee of the son's of the trust in itself, that while the son is alive, that the son will get a certain portion of the assets that upon the death, the daughter could inherit or a charitable institution could inherit. This is more of what we call an estate planning question that would be best handled by a competent estate planner. But there are ways to do what you want to do, but it would need to involve a competent legal advisor that is knowledgeable about estate planning. There's a lot of variables involved in what you just said. You know, one of them is they don't have the management skills to do it. So therefore, it would be prudent to get somebody to help them out that upon your death, they would know what to do. Right? Again, my recommendation is to seek out the assistance of a competent estate planner. That's why we're having this webinar, is because those are the conversations that are not happening, and we're just trying to provoke conversation to make sure that your assets go to the rightful heirs and that you can prepare ahead of time so that when that fortuitous event does happen, you're prepared. All right. Are there any other questions, Andrew?
Yes, there are. Thank you, JP, so much for covering that one. And thank you, Beth, for the question. All right, next question. My spouse and I have a family trust for our home. Should we nominate the trust as the beneficiary for our IRAs rather than just each other personally?
I would talk to your tax advisor or, again, legal advisor, because I try to avoid providing advice with not knowing everything that's going on in your, or even if I did, we're not in a position to offer advice for people. But you know, there are certain things that need to be placed in consideration. The family trust was created for a purpose to avoid certain things. It would be good to talk to your tax or legal advisor that created that family trust. But if all you want to do is to make sure that your spouse gets it upon your death, or you get it upon your spouse's death, for estate tax purposes, there is no estate tax as long as you leave it to your spouse. It's called a marital deduction. And that's as far as I'm going to take it without knowing your complete situation. And that's the reason why some trusts are created, is to minimize taxation from that perspective. But now, if you're going to start naming children as a beneficiary, I would definitely talk to your tax or legal advisor to make sure that your strategy in place accomplishes what you want to accomplish.
Thank you, JP. All right. Mm-hmm. Next question. JP, can you please address beneficiaries that are non-US / foreign-based and have no tax ID?
Perfect. Yeah, we can address that. I would highly recommend Karina to get a piece of paper and a pen, right? Just a little bit of a background while Karina is getting a piece of paper and a pen. Certain individuals may name family members that are non-U.S. residents. In other words, they're not a U.S. citizen or a green card holder. Green card holder just means that they're treated as a citizen of the United States. You just can't vote because they're not a citizen. If somebody names, let's say, an uncle in the Philippines or in the East Coast, a brother in Italy, who's a non-resident alien, or mom in Taiwan, who's a non-resident alien. And number one, their distribution is still taxable. However, the amount of what we call withholding is the amount that's going to be set aside by Uncle Sam upon distribution. Similar to your paychecks, your employers withhold a certain dollar figure. IRAs are subject to that as well. Let's say the amount is $100,000. The withholding amount on non-resident aliens is 30% under Section 1441 of the code. I'm going to go nerdy on you right now. Section 1441 of the code says that 30% of distributions to non-resident aliens will be subject to a 30% withholding rate, unless, of course, the U.S. and the country of origin has a favorable tax treaty, right? There are some countries, like, as an example, Canada, the UK, that has a favorable tax treaty between the U.S. and the country of origin. And it's typically a lower rate. And for example, Canada's 15% instead of 30%. All right. Now, how would the custodian know that there is a favorable tax treaty rate between the U.S. and the country of origin? Of course, the individual, the beneficiary in this case, would certify to the organization that they are from a particular country. This is where the pen and paper comes in. There's a form called a W-8-BEN. You can Google it if you'd like. You can download that form and have it be completed already, if you wish, and have it be on record with your custodian. The W-8-BEN certifies, or it's an affidavit, that this individual, who you named as the beneficiary, is from this particular country. From there, the applicable withholding rate will be applied to that particular distribution. Now, this individual does not have a tax identification number. They need to get one. Now, keep in mind, imagine having this conversation with someone who does not know anything about the U.S. taxation, and now you're going to give them this form from the United States government to apply for a tax identification number. That's why conversations ahead of time is essential. The form that you would need is what we call a W-7. The W-7 is a form that non-resident aliens complete to acquire a tax identification number so that they can take a distribution from an IRA. Once the W-7 is completed and acquired, a tax identification number is acquired, now they can take a distribution. Now let's take this a step further. Let's say the withholding rate was 30% or even 15%, and the non-resident alien is saying, well, I want that 15%. I want that 30%. Well, the only way you can get a refund of that is, number one, you need to file a tax return in the United States. The tax return form that they need to file is what we call a 1040, an IRS form 1040 NR. IRS form 1040 NR. It looks exactly like our IRS form 1040 for citizens, but it just has that NR in it. The IRS form 1040 NR is the tax filing of a non-resident alien. And if they don't owe any taxes in the United States, guess what? Uncle Sam will be more than happy to return whole or in part of whatever was withheld from that particular distribution. The distribution form that they will receive as a non-resident alien is what we call an IRS form 1042-S. That is a reporting instrument that shows money came out of an IRA and that this amount is taxable to the non-resident alien. And if they want a portion of that withheld amount, they need to file a tax return with the United States. And the custodian will apply the applicable tax treaty rate between the U.S. and the country of origin. I hope that answered your question. It was a long, drawn-out answer. But you need that detail if you are naming a non-resident alien as a beneficiary. And I hope I answered your question. The tax identification number is acquired using an IRS form W-7. All right.
Thank you, JP, for the detailed answer as always. Yeah, next question. So the inherited IRA rules have been changing a lot over the past year. Does the beneficiary have until the 12/31 date over the fifth year that the descendant passed, or is it on the fifth year of the anniversary of the date of death?
Okay, that's a good question. When we're talking about the five-year rule option, which by the way is not available for beneficiaries for individuals that have died after tax year 2019, but to answer your question, the five-year rule is calculated as follows. What the rules say is that the five-year rule ends on the year that contains the fifth anniversary of the IRA holder's death. So in other words, let's say somebody died in tax year 2020. The first anniversary is 2021. Second year is 2022. Third year is 2023. Fourth year is 2024. And fifth year is 2025. What that means is that if that was available, right, if that was available, which means, in this case, if the person died after tax year 2019, this is only available for a charitable institution. Everything has to be distributed by December 31st of 2025. That's how that five-year clock works. If the individual was a non-spouse beneficiary greater than 10 years younger, Of course, they don't have the five-year rule option anymore if the person died after tax year 2019. They are now subject to what we call the 10-year rule option. Similar to the five-year rule option, it's calculated the same way, but instead of having to deplete everything by the fifth year, they would have to deplete everything by the 10th year. In other words, they get 10 years to deplete the account. The drawback to that is that they no longer have the life expectancy option if they're a non-spouse beneficiary greater than 10 years. So to answer your question, how do you calculate the five-year rule option? If the person had died prior to 2020, they have the five-year rule option. It's the year that contains the fifth anniversary of the IRA holder's death. Again, let me give you another example. Let's say they died in 2018, and as a non-spouse beneficiary, they chose the five-year rule option. All right. They have 19, 20, 21, 22, 23. 2023, they have to distribute everything. Now, if the beneficiary has what we call the life expectancy option, and what that means is that for beneficiaries of IRA holders that died prior to 2020, as well as eligible designated beneficiaries such as the spouse, a non-spouse beneficiary less than 10 years younger, a minor child, or chronically ill or disabled beneficiaries who maintain the life expectancy option, the five-year rule option is not an issue because they're only going to be required to distribute a small incremental amount using their life expectancy. We did a study. Somebody had $200,000. And let's say a person who's age 30, which has a life expectancy of 51 years. Their minimum distribution, if there is no interest on the $200,000, is around $2,400 for the year. That beneficiary could distribute $2,400 for the next 51 years from that account and enjoy those particular distributions. That's the power of the life expectancy option. Again, what the SECURE Act changed is the fact that the life expectancy option is no longer available for non-spouse beneficiaries that are greater than 10 years younger. I covered more than what your question was. I hope that didn't confuse you, but I felt that you needed to know what the other options are. All right. I hope that answered your question. Great.
Thank you, JP. Right. Next question. So we talked about some of the options beneficiaries have, but David asked specifically, what steps should their beneficiary take when the IRA holder passes away? Specifically, what documents / information will they need when they contact the custodian for the first time?
That is a good question. Now we're getting through, right? What steps should the beneficiary know ahead of time so that when the IRA holder passes away, what documents, information will they need when they contact the custodian? First step, they need to get the death certificate. Typically, the funeral home that the individual is at will give multiple copies of certified copies of the death certificate. The custodian will not take any other form of document that would determine this individual to be deceased without a death certificate. Once their death certificate is received, the custodian will then in turn set up separate accounts for the named beneficiaries. Hopefully, the IRA holder would have completed the beneficiary designation form accurately. In other words, not only to put the name, not only to put the Social Security number, if they wish to provide one, not only to put an email address, a telephone number, some sort of communication piece to the beneficiaries, because the IRA custodian will not contact other beneficiaries to get a hold of a missing beneficiary because it's privy information. In other words, they, for privacy purposes, they will not be able to contact anybody to communicate to that beneficiary that they're an inheritor. Let me give you an example. Let's say there are four kids. Three are very very connected with the IRA holder, but one is an estranged child, but they do get 25%, as an example. The IRA holder may want to put down enough information in there so that the custodian can actually find that last beneficiary. In other words, update the beneficiary designation form to the most current information that you can find. Right. and then from there, get the death certificate from the beneficiaries. And then from there, I hope that the beneficiaries were educated on, number one, that there are fees that are going to need to be paid from that account to maintain that account. If not, it's going to be totally distributed. Number two, what type of investments they are. Number three, there are minimum amounts that may be required to be distributed on a yearly basis to avoid the 50% penalty. So I hope that answers your question, but the death certificate is the most essential one. That's the most essential one. That triggers the custodian to know, oh, the IRA holder has passed away. So therefore, the custodian will then in turn take the necessary steps to start accounting for each beneficiary's proportionate share.
Thank you, JP. Next question.
Absolutely.
So even with a Roth, does it become taxable to the beneficiary? Income plus asset value, question mark?
Beth, the answer to your question is it depends. One of the things you need to know about a Roth IRA, it is not always non-taxable. Because when somebody makes a contribution to a Roth IRA, those are never going to be taxed again because those were never used as a tax deduction. Contributions to a Roth have been taxed already. But to determine the tax-free distribution of earnings or the growth will be dependent upon whether or not the distribution is qualified or not. For a distribution to be qualified, meaning the earnings are going to be distributed tax-free, there are two sets of criteria that need to be satisfied. Number one, the IRA holder must have had a Roth, any Roth, for 5 years. Say, in other words, from the initial date of contribution or conversion contribution, the clock started ticking as of January 1st of that year. After 5 years, one half of the criteria has been satisfied. The reason why I say it depends is that what if the IRA holder had not had a Roth for 5 years? The message here is the only thing the beneficiary needs to do is wait till that 5-year clock is completed. Because the other half to that particular scenario is, in order for it to be tax-free, the earnings to be tax-free, you must have had a Roth for 5 years, any Roth. But you also have to be 59 and a half, disabled, or deceased. In other words, if a person has passed away and they had a Roth of 5 years, all distributions from that Roth IRA are tax-free. However, if they haven't satisfied the 5-year clock, well, contributions can be distributed at any time. Therefore, now it follows what we call the ordering rules. The order in which money comes out if they had not satisfied the qualified criteria first starts off with contributions. Contributions are distributed first, and then conversions, if there are any. In other words, amounts that were taxed in the year that they were converted from a traditional IRA to a Roth. And then last but not least, earnings. As long as the beneficiary does not touch the earnings in a non-qualified distribution, there is no taxation. So to answer your question, it really depends. If the IRA holder had not had a Roth for 5 years, then the earnings could still be taxable. However, if the IRA holder had had a Roth for 5 years and now they're dead, well, then everything is tax-free under that individual's account. In other words, beneficiaries will enjoy tax-free distributions from that individual's Roth for whatever option that is available to them. If it's the spouse, they can take life expectancy distributions for the rest of their lives tax-free under that individual's Roth account, as long as the Roth IRA holder's had a Roth for 5 years. If it's a non-spouse beneficiary less than 10 years younger, like a sister, they can do that as well. A minor up until the age of majority, or a chronically ill or disabled individual, tax-free using their life expectancy. I hope I answered your question. So in other words, it has to be qualified in order for it to be tax-free. But if it's not qualified, well, then it follows the ordering rules. Contributions come out first, conversions come out second, and then the earnings come out. for research purposes for you, you might want to download an IRS form called an IRS Form 8606. Look at part three of that form. That form will walk you through what we call the ordering rules if the qualified distribution criteria has not been satisfied. However, if the qualified distribution criteria has been satisfied, then everything is tax-free from there. All right, Andrew, how are we doing on time? All right, we'll just keep going. It's Veterans Day.
We are rolling here, and we do have some more questions. So thank you again to everyone who shared with us here. So we do have some more questions, JP, if you're up to keep rolling.
All right, sounds good.
Cool. So if I know I'm dying, can I take everything out of the Roth? They are in an LLC in the Roth, and it won't be taxed to me? Then would it go to the estate and won't be taxed since I'm not a multimillionaire? Would they then only pay tax on interest and dividend, capital gains?
I hope I'm understanding your question correctly. If you're dying, first, from answer to the previous question, if your Roth IRA has satisfied the qualified distribution criteria, you can take a total distribution if you want, and there's no taxation. But the answer, the next question is, now it's outside of a Roth. It depends upon who you leave the assets to. If you have a spouse and you leave the assets to your spouse, well, then there's no taxation to that. It's called a marital deduction. There used to be a publication 950, that talks about estate taxes and gift taxes, right? If you leave assets to your spouse, that is not subject to the estate tax at all. The only time assets could be subject to the estate tax is, number one, if you're leaving your assets to somebody else besides your spouse as a beneficiary, and that your assets exceed a certain threshold. That threshold is what we call the unified credit, and I think it's around $11,700,000 today, because under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, that amount was doubled from the previous $5 million bottom line threshold, of course, updated for cost of living adjustments. All right. Right now, if your assets are not above the $11,700,000, those assets will be exempt from, in other words, the corpus of your estate, not just the Roth, but any assets that you leave to somebody else besides your spouse or a charitable institution. The executor of the person's estate would have to gather that and determine the threshold of the individual's estate for estate tax purposes. And if it exceeds that $11,700,000, around $700,000, that amount above that will be taxed at its highest rate at around 40%. So if your assets are way below that, well, then it's not going to be subject to estate taxes. The other thing that you may want to reckon with is, depending upon the state that you live in, the beneficiaries could be subject to what we call an inheritance tax. As you've noticed, there's a lot of taxation involved. Depending upon the state that you live in, the inheritance tax may also be something to reckon with. So talk to your tax or legal advisor. And another website that I found out there, I don't endorse this website, but it's called retirementliving.com. It kind of gives an overview of what taxation is in each individual's state. So in other words, some have an inheritance tax, some have a similar estate tax in their state. So four different levels of taxation. We're talking about federal tax, state tax, federal estate tax upon the death, as well as the state inheritance or estate tax for the state. So from that perspective, do you need to take it out of the Roth? The answer is no. You don't have to take it out of the Roth. You can keep it in an LLC, and the inheritors can still continue to maintain the tax deferment of the assets. But now, depending upon who you name as a beneficiary, that's where the estate tax comes in. See? So if you're leaving it to somebody else besides your spouse, it's going to be a part of the corpus of your estate to determine estate taxation. Now that I've covered that piece, the significance of the bill that they're trying to pass in Congress right now, depending upon what makes in and what gets into that bill, there were proposals to reduce that $11,700,000 that I'm talking about to a lower dollar figure. In other words, pre-Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. There was even something thrown out there pre-EDTRA. In other words, pre-Bush tax cut eras, which brings that dollar figure down to $1 million. In other words, to tax people's estates, quicker than what we have today. So to answer your question, I don't know what the strategy would be to take money out of your Roth if you're dying, because those are still going to be tax-free for your beneficiaries anyway. The issue that you brought up with estate taxes has nothing to do with the taking it out of the Roth. It has everything to do with who you're going to leave the assets to upon your death. All right. Next question.
Thank you, JP. Mm-hmm. So there's been talk that a law will be passed requiring accredited investors to be unallowable for IRAs. So basically barring accredited investors to use IRAs. Is there traction to this? Is there any efforts to be combating this? Do you know anything about this, JP?
Yes. The House Ways and Means Committee included in their initial proposal by Richard Neal that any IRA investments that would require an IRA holder to pass certain requirements, such as an accredited investor, are not going to be allowed under IRAs. That has since been pulled from the proposal because of advocacy groups and because of the industry saying this will not fly with the citizens of the United States. So right now they listen to us, and currently right now that has been pulled from the current legislation. But again, I haven't seen the bill that the House passed, which eventually will make it to the president's desk. Currently right now, we've been told that it is not a part of the legislation. There are certain things that were stripped out from that particular legislation. And this was one of them because of pressure from the taxpayers saying, we don't like this piece. So I hope that answers your question. Currently right now, it's not a part of the legislation. It's been pulled from it.
Thank you, JP. Next question. Can I hold publicly traded stocks in my Roth IRA held by a trust? So a bit outside of beneficiaries, but just a quick permission.
The question is, can I hold publicly traded stocks with the trust? We're not a transfer agent, so currently we do not have a means of doing that. What we are working on a platform to work with a broker dealer to be able to hold publicly traded stocks and trade to make that available as in our platform. So
thank you very much. Next question, kind of more of a statement, but if you have any thoughts on this, I was told not to make my estate the beneficiary as it's too involved and holds up distributions of the IRA. Do you have any
Naming your estate as a beneficiary will subject your assets to what we call potential probate. In other words, number one, as I mentioned in the presentation, when you name your estate as your beneficiary, do you have an executor? And now that the assets that flow through that estate will now be public record, because the court is going to have to publish in a newspaper, typically within a certain radius of where this person passed away, to say anybody filing a claim on this person's estate, So that's what happens. That's why it gets a little bit involved. Because what if somebody erroneously files a claim for your estate that they're a beneficiary? Now it's outside of the IRA already. The IRA does not have anything to do with that anymore once distributed from the IRA to the estate. To avoid all that, if you name a beneficiary, whether it be a trust or whether it be individuals themselves, because an IRA is already a trust, valid under state law. You can name actual individuals that those will not be subject to probate. Those can be distributed much easier, of course, barring any restrictions on the investment. The facilitation of the transfer or the distribution of assets from those inherited accounts will be a lot quicker, because now you only have to deal with a custodian and you would not have to deal with the probate court. So those are the benefits of naming a beneficiary under an IRA. And that's why this course was That's what instigated this particular course, is to make sure that the IRA holders know, what the best ways are to, number one, avoid unintended consequences, such as not talking to your beneficiaries or not providing the custodian enough information so that we can do our job or facilitate that process of getting the assets that you worked hard for to the rightful heirs. Yeah, I hope that answers your question again.
Thank you, JP. Are you good to answer a few more, JP?
Absolutely.
Cool. Yeah, we have about four or five more. All right, next question. So when looking at non-spouse beneficiaries are subject to the five-year rule, question, are they subject to the 10% penalty?
Go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, I was just reading that. So thank you, David. Just so you know, it is a 10-year rule. So then the question is, are they still subject to 10% penalty?
To answer your question really quickly, no, they're not, because those distributions are what we call death distributions. The thing that dramatically affected the non-spouse beneficiaries that are greater than 10 years younger is that they don't have the life expectancy option any longer. But those distributions are still exempt from the 10% penalty. Congress just wanted those distributions to be taxed quicker. Imagine, again, I mentioned a 30-year-old's life expectancy is 51 years. Congress says, I don't want to tax that thing for 51 years. I want to be able to tax everything by the 10th year. So therefore, they removed the life expectancy option for beneficiaries that are greater than 10 years younger and reduced it to a 10-year period to deplete that account. But to answer your question again, those will not be subject to the 10% early distribution penalty because it's coming out of a deceased individual's IRA under an inherited account, and those are exempt from the 10% penalty.
Thank you very much. Next question. I think this is something we might have to pass off, but I would love to hear your thoughts on how do I find a good estate tax planner? Is there a professional association I can research that with?
Unfortunately, I do not have a good a place to send you to. If you're working with a good CPA, they may know of somebody that's knowledgeable about the state laws as well as federal law. Another place to look or to consider having a conversation with before you engage with them are what we call registered investment advisor organizations. Registered investment advisors are held under what we call a fiduciary capacity, and the advice that they provide goes beyond investment advice. In other words, an RIA is what we call a firm. In other words, it's really a conglomeration of different people with different skill sets that take a holistic approach in providing advice, and one of them is estate planning. So by contacting a good registered investment advisor, they may already have somebody in their team that you could actually consult with in regards to your situation. But as far as an association is concerned, unfortunately, I don't have an association to point you to. But a good local registered investment advisor could already have somebody in their team to recommend to you. And of course, then you can also avail of their investment advice, as well as if they have a legal counsel, you might even avail of those services as well. Yes, that would be where I would look at first.
Great, thank you, JP. Four more here. So this is more of a statement, but I'm curious again if you have any thoughts. Diane says, mm-hmm. I was told to limit the number of beneficiaries. I'd imagine this would be for complexities you would deal with when the number of beneficiaries reaches maybe a certain threshold. Do you operate off of any kind of best practice? Not that we can tell them what to do, but just do you
have... Are you folks still there? Something cut off, so I just want to make sure.
Oh, yes, we are still here. So
you need
me to repeat.
There is no limitation for us when it comes to a beneficiary designation form. I mean, think about it. If you have 10 kids, you can't just say, I love five and I don't love the other, right? So I would say there is no limitation. You can do whatever you wish. But most documents out there only allocate like 3 to 4 beneficiaries to be named, because that's generally what's required for most people. But if you do have multiple beneficiaries, you could do so But you may just do what we call, you may just put C attached, that this, you know, same parameters for each one of the lines that you may have in a beneficiary designation form. You may just have I've seen as many as 15 named beneficiaries. It's a little bit of work, but if that's your wishes, who are we to limit you on who you want to receive your assets, right? So, for us, there's no limitation. If there's $3 million in there and you have 10 beneficiaries and you want each to get $300,000 of that $3 million, of course, we'd be more than happy to accommodate that for you.
Mm-hmm.
And there is no benefit by... Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think Diane understands that the regulation allows for this, but I think they've just heard or been told, hey, for like one headache or another to avoid, to limit this, would you say like, oh, it's not really substantiated. It's kind of whatever you want to do, right?
Yeah, there is no limiting factor in the regulations. No, there is no limiting factor. Not at all. The only restriction that you have, again, is what's allowable under the document because of space more than anything. But again, if you want to name 10 children, there's nothing that restricts you from naming 10 children. We will have to set up 10 separate accounts on behalf of the individual, you know, beneficiaries. But there definitely is benefit by, it's less work, but does that accomplish your goal? That's the main concern. If it doesn't accomplish your goal, nothing restricts, nothing in the regulations restrict you from doing or naming whoever you want.
Thank you, JP. Yeah, so Diane, basically, just if you're willing to put in the work and make sure that, you know, 5, 10, 15 of your beneficiaries have that accurate information always, then, you know, feel free to do so.
Thank Absolutely. You, it's your IRA. Yeah, it's your IRA.
Any more questions here?
And no, nobody should dictate what your wishes are. Absolutely.
Great. Thank you, JP. Three more here. Linda asks, for a commodity like silver, does the metal have mm-hmm. to be sold, or can it be distributed physically?
Distributions to beneficiaries could be done in kind. In other words, they can be distributed physically if you wanted to. If you have multiple beneficiaries, it become problematic. And the reason for that is you cannot cut or you cannot distribute coins, as an example, in fractional shares. So therefore, if you are going to give that option to the beneficiaries to be able to distribute in kind, you could put forth an effort in before you pass away to identify which metals you would like to for your beneficiaries to receive, so that upon your death, they're not faced with having to sell something because they can't distribute it fractionally. In other words, if you bought an American Eagle coin and it's worth a certain dollar figure, but it's 50-50 and you can't cut that American Eagle coin in half, sometimes from a practical perspective, they would have to sell it in order for it to be distributed. But if you've allocated which coins are allocated for a beneficiary ahead of time, well, then that would make it a lot easier for the custodian to determine and execute your wishes to be distributed, you know, for them to be able to distribute it in kind by putting those arrangements ahead of time. But to answer your question, yeah, you can distribute it in kind. You can distribute a house in kind. And some people have. I mean, they have worked hard in accumulating wealth, let's say in a Roth, and this house is now all paid for under the Roth. You want to distribute it tax-free. Yeah, it can be distributed in kind. It just has to be re-recorded on the county from the Roth to the beneficiary's name, and that's all done in kind. Similar to what your question is, can metals be done in kind? The answer is absolutely, absolutely.
Thank you, JP. Okay, this last one may be something we have to pass off to a tax advisor, but JP, I'd love to get your 2 cents. So from quote, prospective client asks, what is the maximum tax bracket you would suggest when going to do a Roth conversion? I have a very large standard IRA, roughly about $4.5 million across the accounts, mm-hmm. and do not need the income mm-hmm. from the RMDs. I'm 77, my wife is 71. We are at the high end of the tax bracket and have sufficient assets outside of the IRAs to live on. Last year's RMD was over 200,000, and with tax rates probably going up and possible restrictions on Roth conversions, would you recommend doing all this in 1 year, or this year rather, and incurring a tax bill of over 1.6 million? Or is there a sweet spot to doing some, if not all? Our two children will inherit the funds, and they already have successful financials, so this will probably put them in the highest tax brackets as well. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Well, multi-layered. I'm not going to tell you what to do, but these are the things to look out for. All right. If you're going to do a conversion from a traditional to a Roth, number one, you don't have to do it in cash. You can do it in kind. I would do the conversion in a Roth in a down market, because the fair market value of what you're going to convert will be taxed at the current fair market value at the time of the conversion. So I'm just going to use an example. If you had IBM stock at $100, $100 a share, and you had one share, and now the IBM stock is $10 a share, I'm exaggerating it, I would convert it in kind at $10 a share, because the taxable amount upon conversion is the current fair market value. It will be taxed at $10 a share. What that means is that the amount that's going to be taxed in the year of conversion will not increase your taxable income as much as if you had converted it when the investment is at its highest rate. So that's one good rule of thumb. Pick the investments that you want to convert that are at its lowest value at the time of conversion, if you're going to do it. But the next question actually is something I'm going to throw back at you and say, what are you willing to pay? The reason for that is the amount of conversion will increase your taxable income for the year. You don't have to convert everything, but what are you willing to pay? Or in other words, what are you willing to tolerate from a tax perspective? If you're at the 24% tax bracket, means you're past the 22%, you're earning quite a bit. How much of that can you tolerate paying taxes on? And that can only be answered by you. And as a matter of fact, if you are willing to pay, you know, at the highest tax rate at 24%, where are you before you fall under the next tax bracket? Where does your income fall? In other words, if you're in the 24% tax bracket, how much room do you have before you fall under the next tax bracket? And then only convert that amount that would allow for you to fall below that next tax bracket, and then just convert that amount if you feel comfortable paying that amount of tax. In other words, 24% from a federal perspective, I don't know where you live. You may also be subject to state tax, depending upon the state that you live in. I used to live in Minnesota. We had considerable amount of state tax because we had to fund two seasons, winter and road construction. That was a joke, by the way. So in other words, it depends upon what you are willing to tolerate paying taxes on. Because I can't answer that question for you. Only you can. But what some people are doing as a strategy is, let's say they're in a 22% tax bracket. They're already in a good bracket, because after all the adjustments and everything, whatever had left over still made them fall under the 22% tax bracket. They'll take a look at where they're at in the between the 22 and the 24% tax bracket, and they will only convert up to the amount that would kind of hit the wall of the 24% tax bracket, and they do that incrementally every year. That eventually, as they convert, most of their assets are going to be in a Roth IRA. Number one, it will not be subject to required minimum distributions any longer. And number two, they can allow for those assets to accumulate tax deferred and eventually distribute tax free. So I gave you some principles that you may want to take a look at. You know, which investments do you feel comfortable converting? And if so, are you willing to pay the tax on the amount that you're willing to convert? And that's a preference and a response that only you can answer. And unfortunately, I can't make that decision for you. But take a look at where you're at between the 24% tax bracket and the next tax bracket, and see if you can swallow the pill of paying the tax in that amount, right? Especially if you have children that have accumulated wealth themselves, and they don't want to take another tax burden. By handing them over tax-free is a good strategy. Yeah, I'd like to be your child, by the way, but that wasn't your question. So.
Thank you, JP. And as always, I'm sure JP would echo this, but whenever you're dealing in taxes, of course, your advisor is a smart individual or entity to consult, particularly for you as a high-value investor that would potentially consider moving such an amount of money. I think a tax advisor could really be helpful in formulating a sharp strategy for you and helping you achieve your goals there. Thank you, JP. Well, that brings us to the end of the questions for individuals still on the line. A few people had left, and JP, I'll connect with you offline to get those answered and sent out. But if anybody, please, we still have 43 people that have stuck with us for almost 2 hours. But if anybody has any final questions, please submit them now. But JP, you can get started on sending us home. Thank you.
Well, thank you for attending today's seminar. And I hope that this was helpful for you. And that what we want to accomplish is to make sure that we equip you with enough knowledge to be able to not only make decisions, but even in some cases, just to formulate questions with your tax and legal advisors. We love working with tax and legal advisors because then we know that you have a team that can hear the information from us directly. And if they're knowledgeable about retirement plans, even better. But if they're not, we would love to have a conversation with them, or even have them attend some of our courses, or even sit in some of our events, so that they can not only get continuing education credits, but also, be able to be familiar with the issues that you're facing in managing your retirement plan assets. Again, my name is John Paul Ruiz, Director of Professional Development here at the Entrust Group, along with Andrew Crawford, the rock star that puts this all together for us. And we hope to see you again or attend another Entrust Group webinar. Thank you, and enjoy your Veterans Day. Thank you.